True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
After she begged and begged and begged, and we came across this apartment, and we took her to see it, and she was elated about it, and moved her in. After we moved her in, she decided that she could manage on her own with help. She would go wash her own clothes at the washateria. She also would, she learned how to go to the bank. Just right from her house, and she'd go down and get her quarters and to wash her clothes. She would go to Papa John Pizza. She was right where she wanted to be. She loved Papa John Pizza and Church's chicken breast. Oh. And she was in between both of them. The Dairy Queen was up on Front Street. She was telling me how she loved those blizzards. She wanted blizzards. And she would walk up there in the hot sun and get her blizzard and drink it going back down to her apartment. She would go up to the dollar store. Like you said, she loved cleaning and air freshness. Oh, she would have air freshness stored everywhere. She would go up there and she was able to go get all her stuff and take it home. She would buy cleaning stuff. I don't care how much cleaning stuff she had. It was never enough. And she's been deceased now 2 years this month. And I still probably have enough of Cherry's cleaning stuff to last me another year.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Today's story deals with domestic violence. In this particular case, the abuser was a woman who abused her partners and her children before she ended up killing a disabled person. We have made a donation to Futures Without Violence, an organization which aims to advance the health, stability, education, and security of women, men, girls, and boys worldwide. To that end, the organization was a big player in developing the Violence Against Women Act, which was passed by Congress in 1994. And the organization continues to work with policymakers in training professionals, doctors, nurses, teachers, athletic coaches, and judges to improve responses to domestic violence and to educate people about the importance of healthy relationships. We hope you enjoy this ad-free episode.
Cherry Walker was a trusting, uncommonly innocent young woman with a developmental disability. When her neighbor, Kim Cargill, brought her son to Cherry to babysit, Cherry didn't know enough to question her. Mentally still a child herself, Cherry played alongside the child, sharing her food and her small apartment with him. Kim took full advantage of Cherry, leaving her neglected son with Cherry for days, without providing for any of his needs while she was away. But when Cherry was asked to testify in court against his abusive mother, she was taken out of the picture. Kim knew that Cherry couldn't lie if her life depended on it, and as it turned out, her life did depend on it. Cherry's body was found on the side of a Texas road after being doused with lighter fluid and set aflame. Kim Cargill was soon revealed as the primary suspect in her murder. Attractive, manipulative, with a history of violence, mother of four, Kim Cargill turned out to have plenty of dirty secrets she'd do anything to keep hidden. In The Babysitter's Secret, our quiet end discussion takes us inside Kim Cargill's trial for the murder of Cherry Walker. And we get a glimpse into the mind of one of the most conniving female psychopaths in recent history. So this took place in Texas.
This is a Texas crime. So we have a Texas beer. Now, certain people, not mentioning any names, have been getting on me a little bit about my beer reviews being primarily stout-oriented. So what I'm going to do today is change things up a little bit. I'm reviewing a beer called Omniscience and Proselytism by Jester King Brewery, which is in Austin, Texas. Now, this beer is an American wild ale, which means that it's spontaneously fermented by yeast that just kind of float around in the air. So they tend to be sour and funky. I've done some of these beers before, just not recently. Now, the thing about this particular one, Omniscience and Proselytism, is that strawberries are added to it.
Mm.
Fresh, ripe, beautiful strawberries. So this is an absolutely stunning beer. From the first time you pour it, and it's a pinkish red beer, it's a gorgeous looking beer. There's no head to it, really. And you stick your nose in there, and it's just strawberries.
Yummy, yummy.
Oh, man.
It sounds really good.
A little bit of oak, a little bit of vanilla. And then when you take those first sips, just perfectly ripe strawberries. They're so sweet, so juicy. Ah.
But it has a sour kick as well.
It's got a little bit of funky sourness to it. It's tart. But good. This is just an awesome, awesome beer.
Okay. I can't
wait
to try
anybody
it.
Would like it.
I can't wait.
It's a great beer for those warm summer days, those lazy Texas summer days.
Yeah, well, it's hot in Texas in the summer, that's for sure.
Tends to be.
Okay, we're going to open it up and head on down to the quiet end.
Okay, let's enjoy this beautiful beer.
The quiet end today, not super quiet, a lot of activity going on.
Well, you know why.
Why?
It's the first day of spring.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. No. I thought it was basketball related.
No, this is spring season.
Okay.
Today's the vernal equinox.
Oh, but it's St. Patty's Day, isn't it? Or was that yesterday?
That was 3 days ago.
Oh, okay.
Where have you
Got
been?
Got it. I don't know. Oh, boy. I'm
so,
way behind.
Yes, today's the first day of spring. Now, where we live, spring is a relative term.
Yes.
So it might say spring on the calendar. But realistically, we probably have another month of winter.
We still have a fair amount of snow on the ground.
We do. And it's still cold.
So we won't be sitting on the patio today.
And we won't be going to the golf course today. But we will be enjoying this wonderful beer.
I can live with that.
Okay. Let's do it.
On Saturday, June 19th, 2010, when Guthrie Walker hadn't heard from his daughter, Cherry, he felt like something was definitely wrong. Cherry was almost 39 years old, but she had been classified as mentally retarded and had just recently been allowed to move into her own apartment, with a caretaker checking in on her. She'd been making great progress, and she was happy to be more independent.
Yeah, this was a big deal for her.
Yes, big move.
Yeah, well, her father and stepmother are getting on in years, and they're not going to be able to care for her that much longer.
Yeah, so they want to make sure she's going to be okay when they're not around.
Hopefully getting that transition started, and it looked like it was going quite well.
She was excited about it.
Yeah.
But then Sunday, the next day, Cherry still hadn't called, and she didn't show up at church. Cherry's stepmother, Ruan, called Cherry's apartment and her cell phone, but got no answer. Cherry didn't go anywhere without her cell phone, so this was very unusual. That afternoon, they went to Cherry's apartment, worried. Her tiny studio apartment, which she always kept immaculate, was in disarray. This was very alarming. Cherry was a neat freak who was fixated on collecting cleaning supplies.
Yeah, you heard that in the intro.
Yes.
That's her stepmother testifying in court about all the cleaning materials that she has on hand.
Those were her things, cleaning and eating.
Yeah.
She loved. She was an obsessive-compulsive cleaner. She never left without everything being in its place. Now, as Ruan and Guthrie looked around, they saw that the ironing board was out and Cherry's bed was unmade. Ruan looked in Cherry's closet and in her kitchen. She searched for Cherry's phone or her coin purse that she always carried with her. And when she couldn't find them, she felt a little bit of relief, thinking that Cherry must have gone somewhere, because she'd have those with her if she had gone out absent-mindedly forgetting about church, which was really unlikely anyway. Looking on Cherry's calendar, the only thing written that past Friday was babysit. It was possible that Cherry's caretaker had come and taken her shopping or out to eat. So Guthrie and Ruan went home and waited to hear from their daughter.
Yeah, now that Saturday before, the day before Cherry's parents were looking in her apartment, a Domino's Pizza employee had found a charred body about 50 feet off the side of the road. Now at that time, nobody knew who it was, just that there was a dead body. With little clothing on it. The body appeared to be a large female shape, but it was face down, white sneakers, toes were buried in the dirt, The Domino's driver couldn't tell what kind of shirt she wore because it was melted into her skin. All of her hair was gone. Her face was pushed into the ground and it looked completely burned. Even if he had known Sherry, he'd never have recognized her. So then police officers arrived at the scene of the crime just about 3 o'clock Saturday. They surveyed the scene, roped off the area with a large roll of police tape. Crime scene log was started detailing the time, date, and personnel as they arrived. The road was blocked off to traffic. Now near the body there was a rolled up carpet, and then between the victim's legs there was a half and half Dairy Fresh creamer cup. You know, one of those little plastic containers you get with your coffee at Dairy Queen or
McDonald's
or any of those quick stops.
Mm-hmm.
So it was used and crumpled up. There were also tire tracks nearby, and they were very easy to preserve because there's a lot of red clay in the area. The body didn't appear to have been there for more than a few hours. There was other garbage in the area that looked weathered, but the creamer cup looked fresh, like it may have been dropped at the same time as the body.
Now, Ruan was watching the nightly news on Sunday when she heard the report about a body being found about 50 feet off a road in White House, just over the town line of where they lived in Tyler. There was enough information to make her heart sink.
She knew.
She began to question their decision to let Cherry move out on her own. She was still struggling with daily tasks, but Cherry loved her tiny apartment. She'd begun going out on her own to the laundromat. She lived right between Papa John's Pizza and Church's Chicken, which was just great to her. She loved them both. Her quality of life had improved as she went from being sheltered at home all the time to learning to be an adult. Cherry had worked her way up to walking down the block to the Dairy Queen and the dollar store, where she could buy the cleaning supplies and air fresheners that she loved to collect. She didn't have a life like most people, but she was living a life she enjoyed, and she was gaining self-confidence.
Had Cherry received disability and welfare benefits? Community Access, a nonprofit state-run agency, was helping to integrate her into society. Her communication ability was about that of a 4-year-old, and her daily living skills were around that of a 9-year-old. But she was progressing, and she had a lot of support. So Ruan called the police to let them know she was afraid that the dead woman was her daughter. Policemen came to the house and spoke with Ruan and Guthrie. It took several days to confirm that the body was Cherry, but everything seemed to fit. Now, police were given the name of Cherry's caretaker, Paula Wheeler. Police were given the name of Cherry's caretaker, Paula Wheeler, and her boyfriend or friend, depending on who you were talking to, Joe Mayo. Now, Paula Wheeler basically made daily visits to see Cherry.
She did, yes.
And Monday through Friday, she was there.
Cherry needed it.
Yeah.
I mean, she was trying hard, but she did need a lot of support.
And she was getting it.
I mean, yes.
When you read through the book, Paula Wheeler is one of these saints.
Yeah, I know. Really. I mean, what a thing to devote your life to.
And I guess Joe Mayo was a pretty good guy, too.
Yeah, I think he was a little bit slow. But he cared a lot about Cherry, and they had a good friendship.
They did.
Marcy Fulton was a neighbor of Cherry's, and she sometimes took Cherry to the store for groceries or to rent or buy DVDs. One funny thing about Cherry is she liked scary movies. Of course, she also liked to eat. She was a big fan of Burger King and Dairy Queen. And Marcy was watching a little boy for a woman that she knew. He was 4 years old. His mother would drop him off 2 or 3 times a week with Marcy. But he'd become too much for Marcy, who was a little bit older. He was a lot for her to handle, and his mother was rude and inconsiderate, sometimes leaving him with her for days without calling. So for some reason, Marcy decided to ask Cherry if she would like to earn some money watching the boy. I don't know why she thought that was a good idea, but well, Cherry liked the idea.
You know what I'm thinking, and this might sound not great.
Okay.
But I think she was trying to palm the kid off on Cherry.
I think so, too. But she also seemed to think she was doing Cherry a favor, that Cherry would make a little money.
Well, that's a charitable viewpoint. I think you could also say that she knew that she'd be able to get Cherry to watch the kid because Cherry had some disability.
That's true.
And she was an easy touch.
She was so easy to manipulate.
Yeah.
Well, she was like a child intellectually, so.
So.
Yeah.
I'm not Marcy's biggest fan.
No, it was a stupid idea, and it was harmful to Cherry.
Sure,
I mean,
was.
More than you'd ever know. But Cherry was excited about it, and she said yes. So ever since then, Cherry'd been watching the boy whenever his mother asked. His mother knew that Cherry had special needs, but she didn't seem to mind leaving her 4-year-old with her for days on end. She'd drop him off and leave him, and she wouldn't even call to check in. So now when police went to Cherry's apartment, they saw no sign of an altercation. Her answering machine was blinking. She had a message from her caseworker, Paula Wheeler, and a message from a woman who called herself Kim. Kim said she was on break and needed Cherry to call her back, but the date and time of the messages, unfortunately, were not recorded. So it was up to the police to try and figure that out.
Right. That's what they had to do. So the first thing they wanted to do is talk to Joe Mayo. As we know, one of every 3 female murder victims in the United States is murdered by her spouse, boyfriend, ex-spouse, ex-boyfriend, one of those. So Joe was one of their first suspects. He was about 6 inches taller than Cherry and considered himself an entertainer. He'd been a singer since he was around 3 years old, according to Joe. He had auditioned for American Idol and The X Factor, so he must have had some degree of talent.
He did, but I from what I read, it seemed like in his mind it was inflated, and he was quite immature, too.
Yeah.
But a real sweet guy.
Joe was a nice guy.
Yeah.
But despite his auditions, his current gigs for performing were at small restaurants and bars in and around Tyler on open mic and karaoke nights.
So they weren't really gigs, although he called them gigs.
Right. That's what he called them.
Yeah.
And he also did impressions of celebrities.
Yeah, I would like to hear what he did.
I would, too.
Yeah.
Joe had met Cherry at a local Goodwill where they both had worked, and he said he loved her. He'd take her to movies, take her out to dinner. He told the police that Cherry really loved scary movies, and her favorite was Saw. Ew.
Yeah.
That first one had scared him so much that he refused to watch the sequels with her. I'm with him.
Cherry's caseworker, Paula, was aware that Cherry had been babysitting. One day, Kim was supposed to pick up her son, Timmy, when Paula arrived for one of her visits with Cherry. They waited and waited for Kim, who finally showed up and did apologize. But after that, Paula frequently asked Cherry about Timmy. She was concerned.
Well, sure, because she recognizes that Cherry probably shouldn't be doing what she's doing.
Right.
And she's going to try to stay on top of this.
Right, but she doesn't have the authority to just tell her no.
Well, she can't say you can't do that.
No.
No.
Cherry told Paula that there were times when Timmy would stay overnight because Kim wouldn't show up or call. She was always late, and she never sent Timmy over with food or a change of clothes. Cherry worried about him being dirty, because, you know, she's a clean freak. She fed him and she bought him things. She was a caring person. She didn't think Kim took good care of Timmy, so she wanted to watch him as much as possible. So that puts a little crack in my heart, because you can see, even though she's so disabled, she can see what's needed for this child more than his own mother.
Absolutely.
It's really heartbreaking. Paula told detectives about something that had happened the Friday before Cherry disappeared. Paula and Cherry were out shopping when a man showed up in the parking lot outside of a store, and he handed Cherry a subpoena. Cherry was served with a subpoena to testify in a family court hearing on the following Wednesday. Timmy's father had figured out that Cherry had been babysitting, and he was taking Kim to court. Of course, this wasn't the only reason.
No, but the father was seeking custody.
Yes.
Of Timmy.
Quite rightly. Now, the Department of Family and Protective Services was investigating Timmy's mom, Kim, and they were asking Cherry to testify about whether Kim was negligent or abusive with Timmy. Cherry, of course, was terrified to testify, and Paula told her that she had to go or she'd be arrested or fined. Cherry told Paula that she had to call Kim and talk to her about it. So, who is this Kim person?
Kim Cargill. Is that it? Cargill or Cargill? Cargill.
I said Cargill, but I think it could go either way.
Kim Cargill was a 3-time divorcee and a mother of 4 children from 4 different fathers. She was in her 40s, originally from Mississippi, and she had moved to Texas after college. She lived in White House, which is, as was mentioned, the next town over from Tyler, and it's not far from Cherry's apartment. Kim was an LVN, which is a licensed vocational nurse, and she had worked at several Texas hospitals and nursing homes. She is attractive, long wavy dark blonde hair, nice clear skin. She could speak with intelligence, and she didn't share her problems with many people, including Cherry. But with Kim, there was always some kind of drama. She had a string of ex-lovers and ex-husbands, and she wasn't above using her own children as weapons.
Yeah, her oldest son had already been removed from her home. And if she lost Timmy, her youngest, she was likely going to lose the other two. Then she'd have to pay child support, too. She said she could not and would not ever pay child support. Cherry called Kim while Paula was still with her after she got the subpoena. Kim told Cherry, "Don't tell no one." Cherry told Paula that Kim told her she didn't have to go to court. But Paula said, "Yes, Cherry, you do have to go."
Yeah, you can't ignore a subpoena.
No. So this was at 10:30 in the morning on the Friday before Cherry was killed. And Cherry had handed the phone to Paula. "They want to make Cherry look bad in the court," Kim had told Paula. She claimed to be concerned for Cherry's welfare in this. She said being a witness would upset Cherry. She told Paula that she could hide Cherry in her house on the day of the trial, and Paula wasn't going to have any of this. Paula explained to Kim that Cherry had to appear in court, and Kim became very upset, and finally she became verbally abusive. She told Paula that if the court found out Cherry was mentally incompetent, they would take her baby away from her.
So that Friday evening, at about 8 o'clock, Cherry called Paula and sounded very upset, telling her that Kim had called her. Kim said she wanted to pick Cherry up, take her out for dinner. So Paula tried to keep Cherry calm and told her to take deep breaths and relax. "Don't go," she told Cherry. "Just take your medicine. Don't answer the phone. Go to bed. Do you understand, Cherry? You don't have to go with her." So Cherry said yes, she understood. Then she told Paula that Kim had offered to pay Cherry to come over and clean her house. Now this worried Paula because she knew that Cherry was easily misled and she loved to clean. So she figured that Kim was manipulating Cherry. Cleaning and eating were two of Cherry's favorite things, and Kim knew it.
Yeah, so she is being very manipulative. And of course Paula recognizes that. Cherry said to Paula, "I don't want to go out with Kim, Miss Paula." And again, Paula told her, "You just stay inside, don't answer the phone or the door." But, you know, Cherry's not that strong to be able to resist someone who really wants to manipulate her.
No, she's not.
So now, Kim's a strong person of interest. She had been one of the last people to speak to Cherry. But Kim's only 5'3" and weighs about 120 pounds. How could she have killed Cherry and moved Cherry's 240-pound body into her vehicle and out onto the site where she dumped her? So it didn't seem possible that Kim could have done this, at least not on her own.
Not that way.
By Monday, June 21st, Cherry was positively identified as the murder victim. Joe had an alibi that was confirmed by several people. He'd been with a friend and his girlfriend Friday afternoon. Friday night, he was at a local bar performing. He called it performing, and he would get really insulted if anyone said that he was doing karaoke or doing open mic night. But he was excluded anyway as a suspect in Cherry's death.
Right. And Paula, her caretaker, had meticulous records of all of her interactions with Cherry Walker, including when Cherry had been babysitting Timmy. Her first notes on seeing Timmy at Cherry's place were back in November of 2009. On December 23rd, Paula found Timmy and Cherry eating breakfast in her kitchen. Then looking over her records, she found that Cherry had taken care of Timmy for over half the month of December.
That's amazing to me.
Isn't it? So this mom, Kim, would basically just dump him there.
Well, she probably thought she'd really hit the jackpot finding this woman who would put up with
She's
whatever.
This nice woman who's taking care of everything.
And wouldn't report her, which I'm sure a lot of people had reported her in the past.
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
January and February, Paula routinely saw Timmy over at Cherry's apartment. Cherry was feeding him, washing and ironing his clothes, and playing with him with toys she purchased for him. She bathed him and even took care of him when he was sick.
So it seems like it's almost instinctual, the care she gives him.
Yeah.
I just can't get over that.
Me either.
It's really touching.
In the later part of February, Cherry's doctor told her that it was probably too stressful for her to take on the care of a young child. She had enough to do just for caring for herself. But throughout March, April, and May, Cherry continued to care for Timmy. She didn't know how to say no to Kim, and Kim, as you've mentioned, is very controlling, gets her own way.
Yeah, but this is very clear to Paula that the arrangement isn't healthy for Timmy either. Cherry had really poor judgment, and she would watch her horror movies with Timmy. And these are like hardcore, scary horror flicks.
Yeah, not what you'd want your 4 or 5-year-old watching.
No, I can't imagine what his little mind, how it would deal with that.
Yeah.
I mean, these were movies, like we said, like Saw, Hostel.
Yeah.
And I enjoy some horror movies, but these are ones that I don't even want to watch.
These aren't horror movies. These aren't typical horror movies. They're just bloodfests.
Well, they're not like a thriller.
No.
Or a scary movie like we would watch. They are more like horror gore fests, yeah.
Yeah, like a snuff film or something.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
But they're nothing for a 4-year-old to watch, absolutely.
Well, they're nothing for anybody to watch. There's no redeemable features.
Not really. When detectives looked into Kim's work schedule, they found that she was not scheduled to work on Saturday. She had been asked to work, and 99% of the time she worked when she was asked. But that Saturday morning, she turned down the shift. Then Kim had Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday off to prepare for her day in court in her child custody hearing. So police went to talk to her, of course.
Right. So Criminal Investigations Division Sergeant Mike Steinseifer pulled up to Kim's house, James Riggle and Ron Rathburn on Tuesday, June 22nd, who were 3 days out.
Yes.
They didn't have a search warrant, but they believed if Kim was not involved in her babysitter's death, then she'd have nothing to hide. Even though there was some suspicion against Kim at this point, they wanted to give her the benefit of the doubt because it seemed far-fetched that she could have been responsible for Cherry's murder.
So we've talked several times about being brought in for questioning by the police, and even if you're completely innocent, how you should have an attorney. How do you feel about the searching? If someone comes to your house, if the police come to your house to search and you have nothing to do with the crime, should you allow them to search?
No.
No?
I wouldn't.
Okay. Okay, I'm a little on the fence with that one.
Are you?
Because I don't feel like they're going to find anything, unless you really distrust the police and think they might plant something.
Well, not just that. I mean, I think it's the same thing. If you're invited to the police station for questioning, and you say, sure, I'll go because I know I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
You still want an attorney present.
I agree.
I think it works the same way. If the police come to your house and say, we just want to ask you a few questions or we just want to look around, I'd say not without my attorney.
Okay. It does make them treat you more like you might be guilty.
So be it.
Yeah. Okay. I just wondered how you felt about that.
That's how I feel about that.
Okay. So Kim answered her door. Like we said, she's fairly attractive. She's 43. Her eyes are very bloodshot, and she looks like she hasn't slept. She came across to the police as very standoffish and nervous, but that could have been due to a lot of things. I mean, there's a lot going on with the custody issues and, you know, just a lot of stuff. The detectives asked if they could do a walkthrough of her house and ask a few questions as they were investigating the death of Cherry Walker. Now, Kim followed Dick's advice and said she'd have to speak with her attorney. She was aware of her rights, and she told them to leave. She knew that she was being investigated, so now detectives needed to move faster to get a search warrant. They kind of felt like, uh-oh, we thought she was going to let us search. Now we've tipped her off.
Right.
So we better get moving on that search warrant.
We better.
But Kim wasn't very clever about hiding things or doing anything after that, because her house was a disaster with all kinds of possible evidence when they did finally get the search warrant. But in the meantime, they had 2 officers assigned to park down the block and watch her.
Keep an eye on her.
Yeah, and she did confront them once or twice.
And the police were aware that Cherry had been named in the lawsuit to terminate Kim's parental rights to her son Timmy. If Kim lost the case, she would likely never see Timmy again.
So it was more than just custody, it was parental rights.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was likely the charges would be brought against Kim for child neglect.
Minimally, I would think, yeah.
At least. And as Kim had mentioned to somebody, she might lose custody of her other 2 kids.
I would think that that should be something the state should look into, absolutely.
They would. So a witness came forward who had seen 2 vehicles near the spot where Cherry's body was found. One was a dark-colored truck, and the other one was a white SUV. Now, Kim owned a white Montero SUV. The crime scene unit had tire imprints from the dump site that they wanted to match up against Kim's vehicle. Since they had a cast of an imprint, forensic investigators could place the cast on a matching tire, and it could fit like a mold.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But they needed Kim's car.
Yeah, they can't just walk up to her house and do that.
No, they can't.
No. But investigators felt certain that Cherry was killed elsewhere from where her body was found, and that she was brought there by car and left. So they needed to identify the vehicle that had driven up there and done that. There were no drag marks or foot impressions, so they felt pretty sure that Cherry wasn't killed where the body was found. She'd been driven there, already deceased, and her body had been left set on fire. It took 2 days, but police did finally get a search warrant for Kim's house. And on the outside of the house, her house looked pretty normal. Middle-class neighborhood, small house with 3 bedrooms, 2 baths. But inside, holy shit, it was dirty.
Well,
what a slob.
It was more than dirty.
It was filthy.
Yeah.
I mean, the kids should have been taken away just based on the appearance of their house.
If a DHS person had gone to that house and looked around, they'd remove the kids.
And why hadn't they? She'd already lost one child. You think there should have been visits?
One would think.
Yeah. I mean, we've been through this with other cases. It's just, we talk so much about how important children are, and we just don't look out for them like we should.
They somehow seem to slip through the cracks, don't they?
They absolutely do.
So in this house, toys are scattered everywhere. Bills, letters, coupons, newspapers spread out over every surface. Stuff was piled on other piles of stuff, including dishes, full garbage bags, used bags of fast food, plastic containers, cups. Dirty clothes were everywhere. Blankets and sheets were hung over windows to serve as curtains. One of the bathrooms had used toilet paper on the floor with a squished packet of cocktail sauce on top of it, and the toilet in that bathroom was disgusting, with blood splatter all over the seat and the sides of the bowl.
Well, yeah, she just left her tampons and pads lying around.
Yeah.
So disgusting.
House looked like it hadn't been cleaned in years. However, there were several bottles of bleach and spray cleaners sitting on a bathroom counter.
Curious.
Curious.
The carpet and sofa had several different stains that the police photographed and planned to test. Alongside piles of dirty laundry, police photographed and bagged up 2 of these plastic Dairy Fresh Creamer half-and-half cups, identical to the one found between Cherry Walker's legs. In Kim's bathroom, a detective found a pair of white tennis shoes, and they had the same black soot that they had found on Cherry Walker's shoes. In Kim's washing machine, detectives were interested when they found a bedsheet, just a single bedsheet. It appeared to be stained with a dark red color, but it was diluted from being washed. It was still in the machine, and it was still wet. So normally you wash a sheet, you're going to wash a set of sheets.
Right, not a sheet.
Right. So that's kind of unusual. Kim's car was towed to the impound yard so they could search that, and black soot was smudged throughout the interior of the car. Several African-American hairs were found on the passenger side headrest, so these would match Cherry. They also found a roll of duct tape and more of these half-and-half cups. A top portion of a Dairy Fresh cup was sitting underneath the carpet on the driver's side floorboard, and it matched the cup found at the scene as well. On Thursday, June 24th, Kim Cargill was served with an arrest warrant for the charge of injury to a child. So this isn't related to Cherry.
No, this is from Timmy's father.
Yes. So serious accusations had been made about the way she treated him and the other kids. Not just neglect, but actual physical abuse, which when her children were older, they would talk about that. So let's go over some of the abuses that Kim's children did suffer, because she did like to choke her sons.
She did. I mean, not just choke. The book spends a fair amount of time going over the abuses that Kim wreaked upon her kids.
Yes.
And it's just horrifying. So we're going to give a little tiny synopsis.
Yeah, we're not going to go into it too much. Now, but we need to see, you know, this gives us a picture. We need to get a picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just as an example, so Kim liked to choke her kids. Her oldest son would describe the way she did this almost as a ritualistic act. She didn't just grab them in a rage. She'd put both of her thumbs against the Adam's apple, pushing hard, which created the most pain, wouldn't it?
I can imagine.
They weren't able to scream or breathe. and she often picked them up by the necks, lifting them off the ground. Shortly before her oldest son was removed from her home, Kim choked him with a leather belt right in front of his younger brothers. This happened most every day. Now, one day when he complained, the oldest son, about getting a blue Gatorade instead of a red one, Kim threw a knife at him, almost like a circus performer. Good thing, though, he ducked in time and the knife stuck in the wall.
But that's shocking.
Well, it is. Terrible. And this is just one example of several. She wouldn't throw just knives. She'd throw other objects.
And she was abusive to her former boyfriends and husbands.
And she was physically and verbally abusive.
Yes.
To the fathers of her kids, mm-hmm. to boyfriends.
Right.
To everybody.
Yeah, just a horrible human being. It was just systematic violence, neglect.
That's what it was.
Just a tough childhood. Now, Kim sometimes took her children out to what she called the ghetto part of the city, which was the high crime section of Tyler. She'd park on the street, leaving the windows partially rolled down, and leave the children there without explanation. She could be gone for as long as 4 hours, and the kids just sat there and waited, having no idea if and when she's going to return, and if they're safe there. We don't know what this was about, if this was related to seeing men or doing drugs. We don't know.
We don't. Just that
she was up to something.
I mean, I think the implication is that she was scoring drugs.
Possibly, yeah. And what about the names she called her boys? I mean, so terrible for a young person's mind, calling them stupid, stupid sons of bitches, little fuckers, motherfuckers, dumb little fuckers. Just so abusive.
Yeah, she was a sweetheart.
And people overheard this. So she wasn't even that careful.
No.
No. Didn't care.
She didn't care who heard her. She didn't care who saw her.
Right.
Do these things.
It's true.
Now, she was in jail for the charge of injury to a child, and she was on a $500,000 bond. So the police knew she wouldn't be bailed out, and so they had her where they wanted her as they built a case for murder. It only took about a week for her to be giving out clues about her involvement in Cherry's murder, but she couldn't help but talk, and police weren't sure if she didn't understand that her phone calls were recorded or she just didn't care. But she was pretty easy to listen to.
Yeah. Yeah, which is good. It was helpful.
Yeah. Tell about her former classmate. This is something.
Oh, Suzanne Jones Davis was her name. And she hadn't seen Kim since, like, junior high. But then in late 2009, Kim reached out to her on Facebook. And the two met up that February and spoke a few more times. Then Suzanne didn't hear from Kim until June 2010. Kim called her and left a message, telling her that her life was just falling apart. She said she really needed a friend. Suzanne called back, feeling sorry for her, and Kim explained that the state had taken Timmy, her youngest, and placed him with his father. She then told Suzanne that she'd lost custody of her oldest son back in March. This was the first that Suzanne had heard about any custody issues, and Kim was able to come across as a normal mom when she wanted to. Kim began to call and email Suzanne then several times a day. So it seems like she'd run out of friends locally and she was reaching out to try and find people to testify and help her out. Suzanne was conned into believing that Kim was this God-fearing woman who was being railroaded by her exes.
Yeah, the other way to look at that is that Kim chose Suzanne because she knew that Suzanne could be manipulated.
And Suzanne didn't know anything about her recent run-ins.
She didn't.
No.
So she'd be more willing to take Kim's statements at face value.
Right. Kim communicated with Suzanne on Saturday, June 19th. Kim said she was running errands, washing her car, and grocery shopping. A normal Saturday. For some reason, she added, I tried to find my babysitter last night, but I never found her. And this was just a random comment out of nowhere.
Yeah, just out of the blue.
Yeah. She told Suzanne that two of her babysitters had been subpoenaed. One was an old lady and the other was a young lady, who she was concerned was going to testify that the old lady was dirty and unclean. So here she's turning it around, saying that it's not against her she's worried about. She's worried about the young woman testifying about the older person not
right.
being appropriate.
Not anything about Kim.
Right.
Right.
Very clever. She said she was trying to find the young babysitter. And this was Cherry, but she didn't mention her by name, and take her out to dinner and talk to her Friday night. During this conversation, she mentioned that the young babysitter lived in the same apartment building as Timmy's father. She seemed to be making a really big deal out of finding Cherry, and Suzanne found the whole conversation just really strange and off-putting. On Monday, June 21st, Kim called Suzanne and asked if she had watched the Tyler news, and Suzanne hadn't. Kim said that her babysitter was dead. She said her name for the first time to Suzanne then, Cherry Walker. And Suzanne would say that Kim sounded very agitated. She said that the police had seized her phone and her purse, and she had no access to food or to money. Now, like we mentioned earlier, Cherry wasn't identified publicly until that Wednesday.
Yeah. So how did she know?
Yeah, so it hadn't even been on the news.
No.
No.
Well, it had been on the news about the dead body, but no identification
right.
had been given.
Yeah.
So that's a major slip-up from old Kim.
It is. So Suzanne didn't hear from Kim again until June 29th, when she called her from jail.
Yeah, and this time she asked Suzanne to go to her house to get some things for her. And these items included photos, a jersey, some clothes. So on July 2nd, Suzanne drove from her home in McKinney, Texas, to Kim's house, which is about a 2.5-hour drive. Now, some of the items held nostalgic value, but Suzanne didn't understand why Kim would want some clothes that were lying at the foot of her bed. She began to worry that Kim had her doing something to cover up evidence in her child injury case, so she left the clothes.
Now, one of my thoughts on this is that when Suzanne got to that house and saw the condition of the house, her ideas about Kim changed.
I think so.
She was starting to see what Kim was really like.
Yeah, but that didn't stop her from doing some other stupid, really stupid stuff.
Right. No, she got herself in some trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. On July 7th and July 8th, Kim requested that Suzanne go online and change passwords on her bank accounts and her social networks. This included her Yahoo accounts, email, and other personal sites. She gave her specific instructions for each site. She also asked Suzanne to call her cell phone number, Kim's cell phone number, which the police had possession of that phone, and delete any voicemails that she could. Suzanne didn't know why she was doing these things, but for some reason she did them without questioning. And she'd committed a felony now, tampering with evidence.
Yeah.
Now she would say as far as she knew, she was helping in a child custody issue. And it's true that Kim was not named publicly yet as a suspect in Cherry's murder. But still, use your head.
Yeah, I would think.
It's not like they'd been friends all along.
No, it's not.
No.
But even if they were longtime friends, I mean, someone's calling me up and asking me to change passwords and stuff, I'd be really suspicious.
Yeah.
But not Suzanne.
Rightly so, yeah.
Then we have Michael Darwin and his girlfriend. These are two people that were friendly with Kim. They saw her as a hardworking single mom, and Michael used to help her out by fixing things around her house and mowing her lawn. So Kim texted Michael several times on the Friday night that Cherry went missing, which was June 18th. At about 2 p.m., she texted him asking him to call her ASAP. And he called her back during his work break shortly after. And he said that Kim was very agitated. She was ranting about her babysitter, Cherry, who was going to testify against her and destroy her chances of keeping Timmy.
Yeah, so Michael and his girlfriend, Kara, had a cookout at their house with their children. And after that, they drove to Jacksonville to play pool. Saturday evening, Michael and Kara saw Kim at a Burger King drive-thru. She pulled up next to them, and they talked for a few minutes. So the first thing that Michael noticed when he leaned into her driver's side window to talk to her was how clean her car was. It looked like she'd spent the entire day scrubbing it. I mean, normally her car was like her house. But the inside and outside were spotless now. He actually didn't recognize it from the trash heap that it normally was. It usually smelled terrible and the seats were always covered with fast food wrappers, but this car was spotless. And he said that Kim was in a really good mood. Michael had plans to mow Kim's lawn Sunday, but he received a very strange text from her. This was Father's Day.
Yeah. So the text read, "You didn't stop by Friday night after 8:30 or Saturday morning. I just want to say thanks again for everything and happy Father's Day in person. I hope this means you and Kara have special plans."
So why so much detail about Friday?
I know, because he just saw her Saturday night at the Burger King. She didn't say anything about that.
Yeah, so she's setting things up.
Yeah, the more Michael thought about it, the more he realized that Kim's texts imply that she is home on Friday and Saturday waiting for him to call or come over. She also noted that in several other texts that she sent him.
Detectives believe that Kim was trying to set up an alibi for that weekend. She texted Michael that weekend more than she ever had since she'd known him. When investigators looked into Kim's phone records, many of the texts she sent and received from Michael that weekend had been saved, but others had been deleted. They were picked through and individually deleted. For example, she saved a text at 4:15 p.m. and at 1:14 p.m., but deleted one at 11:45 a.m. and 1:05 p.m. So the text that she kept told this story of her waiting for Michael and then asking him why he hadn't come over. So she thought she was being very clever here, but it actually made her look guilty.
Well, yeah, because of the deletions. Plus, they can find those deleted texts.
Well, yes, they did.
So Suzanne was arrested for helping Kim, and she turned over to police a spiral notebook with all of Kim's accounts and passwords. So investigators are putting together the data from Suzanne. They were also notified by forensics that Kim Cargill could not be excluded as a contributor on the Creamer package, which was found near Cherry Walker's body. So now I have some DNA evidence that strongly suggested Kim was connected to the scene where Cherry had been found.
Yes.
So on July 14th, Kim was arrested for capital murder, which made her eligible for the death penalty. So the warrant contained three separate counts. Number one, that Kim had intentionally or knowingly caused the death of Cherry Walker while in the course of committing or attempting to commit a robbery. So this refers to Cherry's missing phone and purse. Number two, she intentionally and knowingly caused the death of Cherry Walker while committing the offense of retaliation on account of Cherry Walker's service as a witness. Number three, Kim wanted to prevent or delay the service of Cherry as a witness. So the warrant claimed that Kim had abducted and murdered Cherry and conspired with three individuals to cover it up. The medical examiner had concluded that Cherry's death was the result of homicidal violence. Now, exactly how she was murdered was unknown.
And that was a bit of a problem.
It was.
That they really couldn't figure out the exact cause of her death.
Well, they can have a strong suspicion.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And they did, that she was asphyxiated.
But it's just not the same as finding a bullet and then matching the bullet to the person's gun. It's just not as straightforward.
No, and that can pose a problem.
Yeah. I think it did cause some difficulty.
So Kim's phone records revealed how many times she had called Cherry leading up to June 18th. But then after that Friday, no more calls were made to Cherry Walker.
She'd stopped calling because she knew Cherry was dead.
Probably. More circumstantial evidence against her.
Absolutely. So to fully understand the mindset of Kim on Friday, June 18th, we need to look back to June 15th. Kim called Timmy's doctor's office several times that day, demanding information on what had been recorded there about her son. She was refused and she went ballistic. 2 days later, she called several more times, basically screaming into the phone at whoever would answer. Kim's mother had temporary custody at this time. Kim and her mother had been estranged. Kim's rage continued into Friday morning, and she called the office again in a rage, demanding to know why her son was being seen there. Patients walking into the office could hear her screaming on the phone. The office manager calmly told Kim that she was hanging up, and then she did. By the afternoon, the office had decided not to answer any more of her calls, and the whole staff was alerted to keep the back door of the office locked. So what do you think of this situation as a doctor that works in a private practice with kids? Have you ever had anything like this happen?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, there must have been, as you said, the grandmother had temporary custody, but there must have also been some court order that said no information to be given to the mother, because otherwise she's certainly privileged to have information. She's the mother. So there must have been some order saying that. But yeah, I mean, you get into domestic disputes like that, nobody's ever happy.
No, it's difficult. But this is pretty extreme.
This is. But we've had shouting matches. I even had, not in my office, but when I was working in the hospital, I had a father chase a person around the nurse's station with a gun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we ducked.
good thing.
But, you know, crazy things happen when there's domestic disputes.
Absolutely. It's a really scary area.
Now, that Friday afternoon, Cherry was happy and smiling because she had a 2-hour appointment with her hairdresser. So her father, Guthrie, picked her up and drove her back to her apartment from the hairdresser's. Earlier that day, Cherry had been served with a subpoena to testify about Timmy. So in between calls to the doctor's office, Kim had called Cherry several times.
So she was probably yelling at poor Cherry and scaring the hell out of her.
Well, maybe. I think she would realize that yelling at Cherry wasn't going to serve any purpose. She'd have to be sweet to Cherry.
And pretend that they're friends. And
right.
Yeah.
Hence the dinner invitation and all that stuff.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. After Cherry left the salon, Kim called her from her job at 2:14 and 3:29 p.m. Kim left her work at 7:30 p.m. So Kim had worked a 12-hour shift that day, and looking over her phone records, she had made 70 phone calls during her work shift.
Wow.
So I don't know how her patients were taken care of, but wow. Kim was pulled over for speeding just before 8 p.m. that day on State Highway 31. She had no outstanding warrants or other issues, so the patrolman just gave her a warning. And then within 2 minutes of receiving that warning, Kim was on the phone again, asking Cherry if she wanted to go out to eat. So this phone call was recorded at 8:02 p.m., and no one else spoke to Cherry after that.
No one did. Now, meanwhile, Timmy's father had no idea that his neighbor Cherry was babysitting his son. They lived in the same apartment complex, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
Kim called him about the court proceedings scheduled for the following Wednesday, and the dad was very stressed. He was afraid of Kim, who he believed had set his apartment on fire and who had physically abused him more times than he could count.
And this was a previous apartment, not the
right,
one in Cherry's
not the
building.
One he was presently in.
Right.
And he was relieved to know that Timmy was staying with Kim's mother.
Of course, imagine? Imagine having your child with an abusive ex-spouse that you know is continuing to abuse him.
Right. And not just abuser, this is an unstable woman. Who knows what can happen?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, she was a time bomb.
So between 8:02 p.m. when she called Cherry and 12:30 a.m., Kim was unreachable. She didn't call anyone during this time, and her boss at the hospital had been trying to reach her all evening about a patient that they had questions over. So she finally returned the call at 12:30 and said she'd been asleep the entire time.
And this wasn't normal behavior. They could always reach her by phone.
Always.
And they actually said that if they had a shift, an immediate opening, she was always game to come right out.
Sure.
Because she always had the daycare set up.
So Kim's story to police was that she showed up at Cherry's apartment between 8:25 and 8:30. Cherry was ironing clothes, so Kim went to her car to wait for Cherry, and Cherry came out about 5 minutes later. Kim said she drove Cherry to her house because she needed to charge her phone and get cash. The battery in her phone had died on her way to Cherry's, she claimed. Cherry waited in the car while Kim ran inside to charge her phone and use the bathroom.
I just don't find that believable. Just that little beginning of the story, I don't believe.
No.
Because Cherry wouldn't have left her ironing board and gone out. She would have put that away.
She would have.
Because she had OCD. And I wouldn't do that. And I don't really think I have OCD. I'm just really neat.
Well, Kim could have been very persuasive and said, let's go have dinner and talk and then we'll come right back.
I guess so, but she would have had to be super pushy.
Yeah, she
was. Not normal, yeah.
Because I have a theory.
Okay. Which we'll get to now or later?
Well, we can divulge it now.
Okay.
Because I think not so much that it was odd that Cherry left her apartment in a mess, but I think I'm looking at how she could have killed Cherry. Because she's, as you said, 5'3", 120 pounds, and Cherry's twice her size.
Right, yep.
So they think that she was strangled and that the setting her on fire was an attempt to hide that fact.
Well, yeah, it wasn't a lot of the fire around her neck area.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that they stopped at Kim's house and she went in and got a belt and came out and strangled Cherry in her car.
And that's why so much hair was on the passenger side, because her head was back against it.
Yeah. Hmm? That's my theory.
I could believe that.
And then she drove the car to the area where she dropped her off, pushed her out, arranged her body, doused it with lighter fluid or gasoline or whatever, set it on fire.
Jesus, though, that's just so brutal.
So that's a way that this little woman could do it. And we know that she was strong because we read about all the times she struck her husbands and boyfriends, that she really packed a wallop and she had a great arm. She's pretty strong.
Yeah, and I think it's not that hard to push a person outside of a car. You've got gravity on your side.
Yeah.
Because she certainly couldn't carry her or even drag her.
So that's my theory.
Okay. Well, what Kim did was she went in her house, came back out, according to her story, stopped at a gas station and bought $5 worth of gas. So that, to me, makes your story more believable. That means that Cherry was already dead when she bought the gas. And she was already looking for a way to cover it up.
Yeah, that's my theory. Because people don't buy five. Well, I shouldn't say that.
They do. But she had enough money to buy more.
Usually you don't buy $5.
Not usually.
If you need gas. I mean, $5, this was what, just 5 years or 6 years ago? Fairly inexpensive. Would you get a couple gallons of gas?
Yeah. Usually you put, you know, at least $20 in, unless sure. You're hurting for money. And she also withdrew $35 in cash from an ATM, she said, to pay for dinner. She said they arrived at Posados, a Mexican restaurant, around 9:30. She said that they ate and talked, and there was nothing remarkable about it. Kim said she drove Cherry back to her apartment building. Cherry was upset because she wanted Kim to drive her somewhere else. And that's when Kim said that Cherry started to have a seizure in that parking lot.
Yeah, now, the thing with that, I'm thinking, Cherry wouldn't ask Kim to drive her someplace else.
I don't know.
She was afraid of Kim.
Yeah, I think maybe. I don't know. Is she really afraid of her at this point?
Yeah, I think she is.
I think she's intimidated by her.
Okay. Same thing, different language.
Well, I don't think she was physically afraid that Kim was going to hurt her.
No. But the last thing in the world she wanted to do is be with Kim.
Yeah, and we can't imagine where she would have wanted her to drive her.
No. So, but that's when Kim said Cherry started to have a seizure because she was so upset. Now, it had been several years since Cherry had a seizure. She did have a seizure disorder, and she took medication for it. But she had been seizure-free for years. So Kim said she had a seizure when they were about a block from Cherry's apartment. She was thrashing about, Kim said, banging her head against the glass in the door. And she was having a grand mal seizure, which is a generalized motor seizure. So Cherry began to whip herself against the glass, and Kim decided to pull over in Cherry's parking lot. Now, despite the fact that a hospital was just blocks away, Kim said there was too much traffic to get there. She claimed there was no one around. The lot was dark and empty. She didn't call 911. She got out the door, opened the passenger's door. Cherry fell onto the pavement and must have smashed her head. The seizure stopped, and Cherry is now lying motionless on the ground. So Kim said she couldn't find anyone to help her. No mention of Cherry's phone, which she never went anywhere without. Or her own cell phone, which she had just gone home to charge. Kim said she couldn't feel a pulse. She tried CPR, but it didn't work. Cherry was dead. So Kim picked up the 250-pound Cherry and put her back in the car.
I have to say that's impossible.
Well, you know, you read stories about people having this bout of superhuman strength when they're highly stressed. So maybe, but no, I can't picture that.
No.
And her SUV, she had a Montero.
Yeah, it's high up off the ground.
It's high up off the ground. I had one of those little suckers.
Yeah.
You got to step up into it. So I just can't picture 5'3", 120-pound Kim picking Cherry up off the pavement and getting her back in the passenger seat.
No. And at this point, she would be dead weight, so there'd be no assistance from her. So.
Right.
No, I don't believe that. But she said she had second thoughts as she was heading to the hospital with Cherry in the car. She started worrying about how this would look, she claimed. So she said she drove around town for 30 or 40 minutes, ending up on the deserted road where she left Cherry. And then she decided to burn her shirt because she knew that she had gotten her sweat, tears, and saliva on it from her CPR attempts. I mean, reading that, I just feel like it's bullshit. I have a hard time even reading it.
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
You're insulting our intelligence.
You are. Kim would explain that she burned Cherry's body in a panic. She claimed that the $5 worth of gas she bought earlier was actually pumped into her car, and what she had used on Cherry was lighter fluid from her trunk. And like we said, $5 is a small amount of gas to put in your tank when you have over $100 in your bank. But it would be just the right amount to fill a gas can if you're going to burn a body. But at the trial, Kim stuck to her story about Cherry dying after having a seizure and falling out of her car. The medical examiner testified that Cherry had not died of a seizure. She concluded that Cherry had died of homicidal violence.
Her findings could not determine the specific method of the homicide, but they were suggestive of asphyxiation because of small hemorrhages in her eyelids and eye lining, called the conjunctiva. So the manner of death was ruled homicide. Then the burning had altered Cherry's blood levels, so the levels of her anti-seizure medications could not be precisely determined. They were on the low side. So the determination was that the mechanism of death was unknown, even though the manner of death was ruled to be homicide.
So I think that some juries have a little problem with that.
Some maybe would. Not this jury.
No. In closing arguments, the prosecutor went through key testimonies that he said show what happened that day. He said the testimonies showed that Kim was a liar, manipulative, selfish, and controlling. He said every day the DA's office struggled with the fact that the subpoena they sent to Cherry is what made Kim Cargill spring into action. So they felt some guilt. One of the things that bothered him the most was how Kim just threw away Cherry's beloved little coin purse like another piece of trash, just like she did with Cherry herself. He pointed at Cherry's father and said her father should at least get to keep that little coin purse, but it's lying in the trash somewhere, and Kim would never say what she did with it.
The prosecutor told the jury Mr. Walker had to call the sheriff's office on Father's Day in 2010, asking if the burned body found on the side of the road was his daughter. He tells the jury that Kim Cargill has had her day, but not to forget about Cherry, because today is Cherry's day.
Now, Kim's defense attorney told the jury that this case is not as simple as the prosecution was making it sound. He said that Kim panicked when Cherry had a seizure in her car because she knew that she would be the prime suspect if Cherry turned up dead. He said if Kim is really as smart and manipulative as the prosecutor made her out to be, he said if Kim is really as smart and manipulative as the prosecutor made her sound, she wouldn't have made it so obvious that she was going to kill Cherry by advertising it through insistent calls to her. The defense went over the doctor's testimonies, telling the jury that they said it was unlikely Cherry had a seizure, but that didn't mean that it was impossible, and they were really trying to use that to create some reasonable doubt.
Yeah, and the defense also told the jury that Kim Cargill climbed on the witness stand to tell her story, even though she didn't have to because it didn't make sense. He says she knew the circumstances were so suspicious and looked so bad, she panicked. And she wasn't a good witness.
No,
I mean,
she wasn't.
The prosecution just allowed her to talk and incriminate herself.
It was a disaster.
It was. The receipts, he said, are evidence of Kim taking Cherry to the Posadas restaurant. He asked the jury why she'd have gotten cash out when she got gas at the Exxon if she's going to take Cherry back to her garage and murder her. Now, we don't know that they actually ate there together. She could have eaten there by herself.
So the defense conceded that Kim did dump her body and set her on fire, but she was not the killer. So the defense said, as disgusting as it is what she did to Cherry Walker's body, that doesn't equal homicide. Where's the proof? Where's the evidence that Kim killed Cherry? Where is the evidence to show you it was a homicide and that she didn't die of a seizure? Defense attorney Jeff Haas began the defense's closing argument. He told the jury it was not their duty to prove Kim is innocent. It's the state's duty to prove that she is guilty. Haas said if Cargill really was so cold and calculated, she would have calculated something better than burning and dumping a body where it could easily be found. That's the familiar argument of why would they do something so stupid.
Exactly. The defense attorney also reminded the jury that what the state said about Walker's mechanism of death is speculation, and that you can't convict people on capital murder because of speculation. So if someone dies from a seizure, it's kind of a diagnosis of exclusion. You've eliminated other possibilities. So the defense claimed there's a series of lies and circumstantial evidence that convicted Kim Cargill. Now, while Kim claimed she took Cherry out for Mexican food, no one saw the two of them at the restaurant, and Cherry had no Mexican food in her stomach when she died. Prosecution said that Kim's lies were evidence of homicide. Much of the burns on Cherry's body were around her neck, leading to further speculation that Cherry was strangled. And again, remember her son's stories of being choked with a belt.
Yeah, so Kim was given the death penalty.
Yeah, and just a quick couple comments. The jury deliberated for about 1 hour to find her guilty. And then in the penalty phase, they deliberated a little bit longer, I think 6 or 7 hours, to come to the death penalty. So they didn't spend a lot of time deliberating.
It's not an easy thing to get the death penalty, especially for a woman. There are only 6 women on death row in Texas.
That's right.
Ruan Walker spoke in a victim impact statement, telling Kim that Cherry had loved her and her son. "Miss Cargill, Cherry loved you and she loved your son," Ruan said. "She didn't deserve the horrible thing you did. You took her away from the people that loved her. When I saw my baby in the morgue, her eyebrows singed. You took away my memories of her. I couldn't give her a beautiful pink dress. All I had was a black body bag." Smith County Judge Jack Skeen sentenced Kim to death by lethal injection, and I guess it was like a total of 9 hours of deliberation.
Yeah, not that much.
That's pretty quick.
It is, for something like that.
Right. When the defendant took the stand in her own defense during the guilt-innocent phase, she said Cherry Walker had a seizure in her car while the two were driving and that she panicked. April Sykes said that her and her staff had put in about 1,200 hours on this case, and it had been very emotional for them. They became so emotionally attached to Cherry Walker and her family. She was so childlike. The prosecutor added that, in her opinion, Cherry Walker left a legacy of protection for Kim Cargill's children, because now they are safe, she said.
And now her defense attorney argued for his client to receive life without the possibility of parole. He said she would do well in a structured environment provided by the jail. He said that someone who has a mental disorder, such as the defendant's, usually is not violent while they are in jail. And he pointed out that Ms. Cargill had not had any violent outbursts while being housed for the past 2 years in the Smith County Jail. Although he said he was not making excuses for Ms. Cargill, he said that there was sufficient evidence to say her conduct is being driven by her disorder.
Now, they never really gave a disorder, though.
We never got a disorder.
No, because there was no diagnosis.
I'm thinking, what did I miss?
No, you didn't miss anything. They missed it. So, I mean, the defense attorney is basically saying that it should be enough that she's going away to prison. Which, I can see merit to that. I'm not a big fan of the death penalty. So I guess we'll probably never know how Kim killed Cherry, or if she had help with it. But I do kind of like your theory, Dick. That makes sense to me.
It's just a theory.
Yeah. But you said the author of the book on this case was believing the seizure story.
Yes.
That surprises me.
Well, the way the book was written, in capital murder cases, when there's a death penalty, there's an automatic appeal. So that was denied, the automatic appeal. Then there was a second appeal where they found a neurologist or a physician who was going to testify that Cherry had a condition called SUDEP, just sudden unexpected death from epilepsy. And looking this up, this is an entity, but it's exceedingly rare. So it's very difficult to die unexpectedly from a seizure. You certainly can die if you've had a prolonged seizure, where you're talking hours and hours, where the brain isn't getting oxygen during the seizure. But just to have a seizure and topple over dead is exceedingly rare. So that's what the author of the book thought had happened, that she'd had the seizure, died in the car, and Kim disposed of her body.
Yeah, I don't think that's very likely.
No, it's not.
So it was just in April of 2017 that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals rejected 15 claims raised by Kim, who's now 51. 10 of the claims in her appeal contended her trial lawyers were deficient for not presenting evidence that Cherry died in June 2010 of the seizure rather than the homicidal violence. The court said 3 other claims were rejected because they should have been raised in an earlier appeal following her conviction, and 1 was refused because it had been raised and rejected in that earlier appeal. The final claim argued attorneys handling the previous appeal were deficient for not arguing that an autopsy photo allowed into evidence that was improper and prejudicial. So Kim is one of six women on death row, and one of her neighbors there is the notorious Darlie Routier.
We've covered that case.
That case has been in our feedback at least a dozen times.
It keeps coming back. And Darlie's exhausted all her appeals.
I wonder how much they associate with each other on death row.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I always picture them separated, but then that Geraldo special on Scott Peterson, he was out playing basketball.
Yeah. So this appeal that was denied or rejected in April of 2017 centered around the testimony of this other physician that she had SUDEP.
Uh-huh.
So that was denied. And then in October of 2017, the United States Supreme Court declined to hear the case. So that's it.
So no more.
You can't do any more than that.
Wow. Okay.
So Kim is waiting to be executed.
Okay.
So that's a happy note to end on, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if it's happy, but it does seem kind of just. So listening to free podcasts is really great, isn't it?
It is.
But I know, as a podcast listener myself, that the one thing I always wonder is, hey, how can I find a way to spend some money on this hobby? If you're like me and you want to throw a little money into your podcast listening adventures, or if you just really like listening to True Crime Brewery and you've run out of episodes to listen to, there are ways to give some financial support and get access to members-only full-length episodes of True Crime Brewery. On our website, you can sign up to have access to our members-only TCB episodes. It's very affordable at $3 or $5 a month. You choose how much you want to pay. We have about 20 of them in the can now, with new ones being released monthly. Coming up this week, we're doing an episode on Amish serial killer Eli Stutzman and the death of his son Danny, also known in the press as Little Boy Blue. When you sign up, we're going to send you a thank you package, too. If you're a $5 a month subscriber, we're going to send you one of our True Crime Brewery snifters, Dick's go-to glass for the beers he reviews on the show, plus a sticker, some coasters, and maybe even a magnet. It's a fun thing to find in your mailbox or on your doorstep one day. I mean, one thing nowadays, you don't get the mail you used to get. You get packages, you get Amazon stuff, but who really sends you a letter or a personal gift anymore?
Nobody.
Nobody. Like a thing of the past. So this is a throwback.
If
you contribute $3 a month, you're going to get a sticker and a magnet, plus you're going to get a True Crime Brewery credit card-sized bottle opener. One more thing, our new t-shirts are here, and they're up for sale on our website. Our website is www.tiegrabber.com. Check out our new t-shirts or buy one of our classic tees. They're up for sale now for $18 and $15, respectively. So that's all I have to do for salesmanship. Let's have a little feedback.
Okay.
All right, Dick, you go first.
Okay. So I have a note from Megan, which is the subject is New Zealand craft beers. Hi, guys. Love your podcast. I just wanted to let you know about the craft beer scene in New Zealand. It is fantastic, with lots of experimental brews, all beautifully packaged. I have included a link to my favorite brewery, the Garage Project. I highly recommend the Day of the Dead. So I looked at this place. It looks pretty nice. They make a lot of sours, your favorite.
Yes, definitely.
And the Day of the Dead is a chili beer. That sounds pretty interesting. I like a little spice sometimes.
Ooh,
in the beer.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think we should
make a trip.
Well, I'd like to go to New Zealand anyway.
Me too.
Australia, New Zealand. So that'd be something pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's try that.
Okay.
All right. So we'll meet you there, Megan.
Yeah. If she wants a case, she could always ship us a beer. We'd have to pay for shipping, because it'd probably cost a lot.
I have no idea.
But we'd do that, right?
We would.
It would be a business expense. Okay, I have a case suggestion from Judy T. Hi, Jill and Dick. You did such a good job with the Cherie Beasley case last week. Please cover the case of Megan Kanka for me. So I looked up the Megan Kanka case, and just a brief summary here. Megan was raped and murdered by her neighbor, a convicted sex offender named Jesse Timenquas, who lured her to his house with the promise of seeing a new puppy. He dumped her body in a nearby park. Then he confessed, and he was sentenced to death. But in 2007, New Jersey abolished the death penalty, so his sentence was commuted to life in prison. Her murder led to a federal Megan's Law in 1996, which provided for the public dissemination of information from sex offender registries. such as when an offender moves into a community. So I like to do cases that are responsible or that laws are named after. It's always interesting to see how that comes about.
Well, let's put that in the queue.
Although, you know, of course, it's a real heartbreaking case, but it might be something to do. So thank you, Judy.
Thank you. Okay, Stephen M. on false convictions and a case suggestion. He says, sorry, but I am one of your listeners who believes that Atif Rafe and Sebastian are guilty in the murders of Rafe's family. But here's an actual false conviction that he wanted to have covered.
Oh, a different case. Okay, cool.
So James Joseph Richardson lost 7 children to murder, and then he was wrongfully convicted of that crime. So in 1968, we're looking 50 years ago, Richardson and his wife had gone to work in the orange groves, about 16 miles away from their home in Arcadia, Florida. They left the kids in the care of a babysitter, Bessie Reese. After eating lunch at home, the 3 school-aged children returned to class where teachers noticed they looked ill. Upon sending them to the hospital, someone from the school went to check on the other kids and found them all sick also. Eventually, all 7 kids would die due to poisoning.
Jesus.
So despite no physical evidence tying James to the murder, he was convicted of all 7 deaths and sentenced to die. Throughout the years, Bessie Reese confessed to the murders several times. The inmate who claimed Richardson confessed to him recanted his story, claiming he had been offered a lighter sentence to corroborate. An attorney and author, Mark Lane, took up the case and presented a compelling evidence of his client's innocence. Now, despite all this, it took nearly 22 years to get the case retried, but he was finally freed at age 53.
Oh, well, thank goodness for that.
Please cover this case. Love the show. Steve.
I like the sound of that case.
Okay. Here's another one.
I wonder what the kids were poisoned with, and I wonder what they were saying his motive was.
Yeah, exactly.
That seems strange. I have a note from Sam L. on our most recent episode, A Beheading on Mount Baldy, and this is in regards to elder abuse. Hi, Jill and Dick. Your latest episode about the murder of Jack Irwin by the 2 women on Mount Baldy was just heartbreaking. The way Marcia talked so casually about cutting off Jack's head and disposing of his body was just shocking and disgusting. So often we think about the safety of our children, but our elderly are definitely just as much at risk and just as vulnerable. As a psychiatric social worker, I work with a lot of older people in difficult situations. They can be very trusting, and they sometimes have a lot of money saved up. This makes them desirable and easy targets for selfish, evil people. Please consider covering more cases about these folks. Unfortunately, living a long life does not protect us from becoming victims. It's important that we are all looking out for people of all ages. P.S. Your episode on Dorothea Puentes was great, too. Proof that you're never too old to be a victim or a psychotic killer.
Yeah, that's right.
Thanks, Sam. I agree with you.
We do. So, case suggestion from Matthew M. I just listened to your show about Susan Smith. It's just such an unbelievable case. Here's a similar case from my state of South Carolina you might want to cover. Like Susan Smith, South Carolina mother Shaquan Dooley staged the death of her 2 sons, 2-year-old Devian and 18-month-old Javon. She is depressed over failing her online classes and being out of work, and Shaquan snapped and thought that ending her children's lives would alleviate some of her stress. She also didn't like that her mother called her a bad parent and the children's father wasn't involved in their lives. So Shaquan first suffocated the kids in a motel room and then drove to a river 10 miles away where the car was driven into the river. The mother stated that she was involved in an accident, but investigators didn't see any signs of tire marks, which would indicate that she had tried to stop the car before driving it into the river. She did later confess to murdering her children and was sentenced to 35 years in prison. The presiding judge of her case, Edgar Dixon, said he appreciated Dooley owning responsibility for her actions. However, he also stressed that she still needed to be punished for her crimes.
I would agree, but it sounds like in her case she definitely needed some psychiatric help.
It does, doesn't it?
I often wonder what part that plays when people are imprisoned, and I often think probably not enough.
No, probably not. And you know that they're not going to get any therapy in prison.
No. I don't know. I mean, they have groups and things in prison. I don't know how good it is, but
I don't think it's,
you don't think
very
it's
effective.
Adequate.
Now, Matthew M. also has a beer suggestion for me. of Palmetto Trail Pale Ale from R.J. Rocker's Brewing Company.
That's in South Carolina?
In South Carolina, upstate, I think.
Okay.
And in fact, I did a beer review way back. Like maybe the second or third case we did was a R.J. Rocker's beer, a Nutty Squirrel or something like that.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
But we've done an R.J. Rocker beer before.
Okay, so we could do another?
Sure.
I have a case suggestion from Aaron, and it is about an unsolved case, the Bennett Family Murders. The Bennett Family Murders is a case that goes back more than 3 decades. It begins with a woman killed with a hammer in Lakewood, and a week later, a family killed the same way in Aurora. The killer was never brought to justice, but new technology is getting detectives closer and closer to solving this brutal mystery. The Bennett family had just moved into their Aurora home around Thanksgiving. It was a quiet cul-de-sac, and most of the homes were still empty. Their daughter, Melissa, was about to celebrate her 8th birthday, but she never would. On the night of January 16, 1984, a man entered the Bennett's home. After 30 years, the Bennett family murders remain unsolved. But the man fatally stabbed and bludgeoned 27-year-old Bruce Bennett, sexually assaulted and bludgeoned his wife Deborah, who was 26. Then he sexually assaulted and fatally beat 7-year-old Melissa and shattered the face of 3-year-old Vanessa Bennett. But she survived. "That's a shock to your life because I'm the one who found the kids," says Constance Bennett, who's Bruce's mother. Constance remembers the house was too quiet, then finding her family brutally murdered inside. To make the case even more complicated, a week prior to the Bennett family murders, DNA evidence would later find the same man murdered Patricia Smith, a 50-year-old woman, in her Lakewood home with a hammer. The murder weapon was never found, but the killer left DNA behind at both of the crime scenes. DNA evidence has let the Aurora police create a composite photo of what the suspect looked like at the time of the murder and what he would look like now. Now they know for sure, thanks to newly developed technology that uses DNA like a blueprint to make predictions about a person's appearance. We know we're looking at someone of Western Northern descent as opposed to Hispanic, male or black male, so it's been narrowed down to that. Detectives were hoping someone would know who this person is or remember seeing someone that night, but the photo's been released and every tip has come up empty. Even though leads grew cold and storylines faded, detectives continued to work in hopes of bringing justice to the entire Bennett family. Now, there was no forcible entry into the home, and Deborah Bennett's purse was found in the front of the house with the contents spilled in the snow. Detectives did recover the knife that was used in the murders in the front yard, but the hammer was never found, so this remains a mystery. So I'll look into that, Aaron.
Yeah.
I don't know how much we can come up with on it. It's usually the problem. We want to make sure we have enough to make an episode, but I'm going to look into it.
Let's check it.
Okie dokie.
And I got one that sounds interesting because it's from France.
That's
so
new.
So we've never done a French crime. We've done British Isles crimes.
Well, anything with English speaking is much easier for us to research.
True. Well, we'll see. This is a case suggestion from Kimberly S. So in 2011, Agnes Dupont de Ligon and her 4 children, ages 13 to 21, were shot and killed with a .22 caliber rifle with a silencer on it while asleep in their beds in western France. The murderer also killed their 2 Labrador retrievers. So the father, Javier Dupont de Ligon, immediately became the prime suspect, as he abruptly disappeared after the murders, had a mistress to whom he owed money, and a failing business. In addition, he had also called the children's schools, informing them that the family was emigrating, and he terminated the lease on their house. So these are all fairly suspicious things, aren't they?
Sure are, yeah.
So there was a missing persons report filed, and the police went to the home of the family to look for them, and they saw a severed leg poking out of the garden.
Ew.
The bodies were individually rolled up in sleeping bags, covered in lime, and buried beneath the patio in the backyard. A manhunt got underway when the suspect's car was discovered abandoned at a nearby hotel. Authorities believe that Dupont de Ligon may have committed suicide. No body's ever been found. Now, the interesting thing, in 2015, a photograph of Dupont de Ligon with a letter from him arrived at the desk of a journalist. The letter said, "I am still alive," but offered no further information on Dupont de Ligon's whereabouts.
This was supposed to be a present-day photo of him at the appropriate age?
Yep.
Wow.
It also isn't clear whether he did in fact send this letter and photograph or whether the latter was a forgery.
That's intriguing, though.
It is. Let's look some stuff up. I'll do that.
That would be really nice if you would.
Okay. All right. That's it for feedback.
Okay. All right. And we do have a lot of feedback. So if you send in feedback, please don't get discouraged.
Yeah, I'm a slow reader.
Yeah. Keep sending in your feedback. We absolutely appreciate it. So until next time, we'll be waiting here at the Quiet Inn.
We will.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.